prepared to pamper you in the style to which you are quickly becoming accustomed. You flip back through the menu. You hate rabbit. Veal is politically incorrect. You're appropriately apathetic about vegetable lasagna. And as you scan the list, you decide that there are just four dishes that strike your rapidly swelling fancy. The partridge, the venison gumbo, the blackened mahi-mahi, and the saffron seafood risotto. The partridge is clearly your favorite, and even without a pear tree, you're tempted to order 12 of them. But that would be so gauche, so déclassé, and what's more, you would miss the spice of life. So you ask the maitre d' to prepare the partridge every other month, and to fill in the remaining 6 meals with equal episodes of gumbo, mahi-mahi, and risotto. You may be one snappy dresser, mon ami, but when it comes to food, you've just cooked your own goose. Researchers studied this experience by inviting volunteers to come to the laboratory for a snack once a week for several weeks. They asked some of the volunteers to choose all their snacks in advance, and just as you did, these volunteers usually opted for a healthy dose of variety. Next, the researchers asked a new group of volunteers to come to the lab once a week for several weeks. The volunteers in the low variety group were fed their favorite snack every time, and the volunteers in the high variety group were fed their favorite snack on most occasions, and their second favorite snack on others. When the researchers measured the volunteers' satisfaction over the course of the study, they found that volunteers in the low variety group were more satisfied than were volunteers in the high variety group. In other words, variety made people less happy, not more. Now, wait a second, there's something fishy here, and it isn't the mahi-mahi. How can variety be the spice of life when one sits down with a friend at a fancy restaurant, but the bane of one's existence when one orders snacks to be consumed in successive weeks? Among life's cruelest truths is this one. Wonderful things are especially wonderful the first time they happen, but their wonderfulness wanes with repetition. Just compare the first and last time your child said mama or your partner said I love you, and you'll know exactly what I mean. When we have an experience on successive occasions, hearing a particular sonata, making love with a particular person, watching the sunset from a particular window of a particular room, we quickly begin to adapt to it, and the experience yields less pleasure each time. Psychologists call this habituation. Economists call it declining marginal utility, and the rest of us call it marriage. But human beings have discovered two devices that allow them to combat this tendency, variety and time. One way to beat habituation is to increase the variety of one's experiences. Hey, honey, I have a kinky idea. Let's watch the sunset from the kitchen this time. Another way to beat habituation is to increase the amount of time that separates repetitions of the experience. Clinking champagne glasses and kissing one's spouse at the stroke of midnight would be a relatively dull exercise were it to happen every evening. But if one does it on New Year's Eve and then allows a full year to pass before doing it again, the experience will offer an endless bouquet of delights, because a year is plenty long enough for the effects of habituation to disappear. The point here is that time and variety are two ways to avoid habituation, and if you have one, then you don't need the other. In fact, and this is the really critical point, so please put down your fork and listen, when episodes are sufficiently separated in time, variety is not only unnecessary, it can actually be costly. I can illustrate this fact with some precision if you allow me to make a few reasonable assumptions. First, imagine that we can use a machine called a hedonimeter to measure a person's pleasure in hedons. First, let's assume that the first bite of partridge provides you with, say, 50 hedons, whereas the first bite of gumbo provides you with 40 hedons. This is what it means to say that you favor partridge over gumbo. Second, let's assume that once you take a bite of a dish, each subsequent bite of the same dish, taken within, say, 10 minutes, provides one less hedon than the bite before it did. Finally, let's assume that you normally eat at the brisk pace of one bite every 30 seconds. If we make these assumptions, then the best way to maximize your pleasure in this case is to start with the partridge and then switch to the gumbo after taking 10 bites, which happens after 5 minutes. Why switch? Because the 11th bite of partridge, taken at minute 5.5, would bring you a mere 39 hedons, whereas a bite of the as-yet-untasted gumbo would yield 40. So this is the precise point in the meal at which you and your friend should trade plates, seats, or at least mouse ears. But all of this radically changes when we alter the rate at which you eat. Recall that habituation occurs when your bites are separated by less than 10 minutes. Thus, if you took one bite every 15 minutes, then habituation no longer occurs, which means that every bite is as good as the first, and a bite of gumbo is never better than a bite of partridge. In other words, if you could eat slowly enough, then variety would not only be unnecessary, it would actually be costly, because a bite of gumbo would always provide less pleasure than yet another bite of partridge. If all of this seems a bit hard to follow, then please trust that the math works out quite nicely when you have a pencil and paper in front of you. Now, when you and your friend sat down at the imaginary restaurant together, you ordered two dishes to be eaten simultaneously. You knew that you wouldn't have much time between bites, so you asked for variety to spice things up. Good call. But when the maitre d' asked you to order a sequence of meals in advance, you asked for variety then, too. Why did you ask for variety when you already had time? Blame the spatial metaphor. Because you thought of dishes that were separated in time by imagining dishes that were separated by a few inches on a single table, you assumed that what was true of spatially separated dishes would be true of temporally separated dishes as well. When dishes are separated by space, it makes perfectly good sense to seek variety. After all, who would want to sit down at a table with 12 identical servings of partridge? We love sampler plates, poo-poo platters, and all-you-can-eat buffets because we want, and should want, variety among alternatives that we will experience in a single episode. The problem is that when we reason by metaphor and think of a dozen successive meals in a dozen successive months as though they were a dozen dishes arranged on a long table in front of us, we mistakenly treat sequential alternatives as though they were simultaneous alternatives. This is a mistake, because sequential alternatives already have time on their side. Hence, variety makes them less pleasurable rather than more. Starting now. Because time is so difficult to imagine, we sometimes imagine it as a spatial dimension, and sometimes we just don't imagine it at all. For example, when we imagine future events, our mental images will usually include the relevant people, places, words, and actions, but they rarely include a clear indication of the time in which those people and those places are speaking and acting. When we imagine ourselves discovering our spouse's infidelity on New Year's Eve, our mental image looks very much like a mental image of ourselves discovering the infidelity on Purim, Halloween, or Russian Orthodox Easter. Indeed, the mental image of finding your spouse in bed with the mailman on New Year's Eve changes dramatically when you substitute barber for spouse, or conversation for bed, but hardly at all when you substitute Thanksgiving for New Year's Eve. In fact, it's just about impossible to make this substitution because, alas, there is nothing in the mental image to change. We can inspect a mental image and see who is doing what and where, but not when they are doing it. In general, then, mental images are atemporal. So how do we decide how we'll feel about things that are going to happen in the future? The answer is that we tend to imagine how we would feel if those things happened now, and then we make some allowance for the fact that now and later are not exactly the same thing. For instance, ask a heterosexual teenage boy how he would feel if one of the Budweiser babes were to show up at his door right now, bikini-clad, cooing, and in desperate need of a massage. His reaction will be visible. He'll smile, his eyes will widen, his pupils will contract, his cheeks will flush, and other systems will respond as nature intended. Now, if you ask a different teenage boy precisely the same question, but substitute the phrase, in 50 years, for right now, you'll notice approximately the same initial response. Indeed, for a moment you might even suspect that this second teenager is focusing entirely on his mental image of the barefoot goddess with the bee-sting lips, and that he's failing to consider the fact that this imaginary event is supposed to be taking place a half-century hence. But give him some time, say, a few hundred milliseconds. As the milliseconds pass, you'll notice that his initial rush of enthusiasm fades, as he considers the date of the imaginary event, realizes that adolescent males have one set of needs and grandfathers another, and correctly concludes that a cameo appearance by a nubile nymphette will probably not be quite as stimulating in his golden years as it would be in his testosterone-charged present. His initial flip and subsequent flop are quite revealing because they suggest that when he was asked to imagine the future event, he began by imagining the event as though it were happening in the present and only then considered the fact that the event would take place in the future, when maturity will have taken its inevitable toll on his eyesight and his libido. Why does this matter? After all, in the final analysis, the teenager did take into account the fact that now and 5 decades from now are not the same thing, so who cares if he considered this fact only after he was momentarily transfixed by his mental image of the airbrushed vixen from Planet Bud? I care, and you should care too. By imagining the event happening now and then correcting for the fact that it was actually going to happen later, the teenager used a method for making judgments that's quite common, but that inevitably leads to error. To understand the nature of this error, consider a study in which volunteers were asked to guess how many African countries belong to the United Nations. Rather than answering the question straight away, the volunteers were asked to make their judgments by using the flip-then-flop method. Some volunteers were asked to give their answer by saying how much larger or smaller it was than 10, and other volunteers were asked to give their answers by saying how much larger or smaller it was than 60. In other words, volunteers were given an arbitrary starting point and were asked to correct it until they reached an appropriate ending point. Just as the teenager used an image of a beautiful woman in the present moment as a starting point for his judgment, "I'm wildly excited," and then corrected it to achieve an ending point for his judgment. But since I'll be 67 years old when all this happens, I probably won't be quite as excited as I am now. The problem with this method of making judgments is that starting points have a profound impact on ending points. Volunteers who started with 10 guessed that there were about 25 African nations in the UN, whereas volunteers who started with 60 guessed that there were about 45. Why such different answers? Because volunteers began their task by asking themselves whether the starting point could be the right answer, and then, realizing that it couldn't, moved slowly towards a more reasonable one. 10 can't be right. How about 12? Nope, still too low. 14? Maybe 25. Alas, because this process requires time and attention, the group that started with 10 and the group that started with 60 got tired and quit before they met in the middle. This really isn't so strange. If you asked a child to count upward from 0 and another child to count downward from 1,000,000, you could be pretty sure that when they finally got exhausted, gave up, and went off in search of eggs to throw at your garage door, they would have reached very different numbers. Starting points matter because we often end up close to where we started. When people predict future feelings by imagining a future event as though it were happening in the present and then correcting for the event's actual location and time, they make the same error. For example, volunteers in one study were asked to predict how much they would enjoy eating a bite of spaghetti and meat sauce the next morning or the next afternoon. Some of the volunteers were hungry when they made this prediction, and some were not. When volunteers made these predictions under ideal conditions, they predicted that they would enjoy spaghetti more in the afternoon than in the morning. And their current hunger had little impact on their predictions. But some of the volunteers made these predictions under less than ideal conditions. Specifically, they were asked to make these predictions while simultaneously performing a second task in which they had to identify musical tones. Research has shown that performing a simultaneous task such as this one causes people to stay very close to their starting points. And indeed, when volunteers made predictions while identifying musical tones, they predicted that they would like spaghetti just as much in the morning as in the afternoon. What's more, their current hunger had a strong impact on their predictions, so that hungry volunteers expected to like spaghetti the next day, no matter when they ate it, and sated volunteers expected to dislike spaghetti the next day, no matter when they ate it. This pattern of results suggests that all volunteers made their predictions by the flip-then-flop method. They first imagined how much they would enjoy eating the spaghetti in the present, yum if they were hungry and yuck if they were full, and then used this pre-feeling as a starting point for their prediction of tomorrow's pleasures. Then, just as the hypothetical teenager corrected his judgment when he considered the fact that his current appreciation of a curvaceous coquette would probably be different 50 years later, the volunteers corrected their judgments by considering the time of day at which the spaghetti would be eaten. Spaghetti for dinner is terrific, but spaghetti for breakfast? Yuck. However, volunteers who had made their predictions while identifying musical tones were unable to correct their judgments, and as such, their ending point was quite close to their starting point. Because we naturally use our present feelings as a starting point when we attempt to predict our future feelings, we expect our futures to feel a bit more like our presents than they actually will. Next to nothing. If you have no special talents or intriguing deformities but are still harboring a secret desire to get into Guinness World Records, here's something you might try. March into your boss's office on Monday morning and say, "I've been with the company for some time, I believe my work has been excellent, and I'd like a 15% pay cut, though I could settle for 10 if that's all the firm can manage right now." The Guinness folks will be taking careful notes because in the long and often contentious history of labor relations, it's unlikely that anyone has ever before demanded a pay cut. Indeed, people hate pay cuts. But research suggests that the reason they hate pay cuts has very little to do with the pay part and everything to do with the cut part. For instance, when people are asked whether they would prefer to have a job at which they earned $30,000 the first year, $40,000 the second year, and $50,000 the third year, or a job at which they earned $60,000, then $50,000, then $40,000, they generally prefer the job with the increasing wages, despite the fact that they would earn less money over the course of the 3 years. This is quite curious. Why would people be willing to reduce their total income in order to avoid experiencing a cut in pay? Comparing with the past. If you've ever fallen asleep one night with the television blaring and been awakened another night by a single footstep, then you already know the answer. The human brain is not particularly sensitive to the absolute magnitude of stimulation, but it is extraordinarily sensitive to differences and changes, that is, to the relative magnitude of stimulation. For example, if I blindfolded you and asked you to hold a wooden block on your hand, would you be able to tell me if I then placed a pack of gum on top of it? The answer is, it depends. And what it depends on is the weight of the block. If the block weighed only an ounce, then you'd immediately notice the 500% increase in weight when I added a 5-ounce pack of gum. But if the block weighed 10 pounds, then you'd never notice the 0.03% increase in weight. There is no answer to the question, can people detect 5 ounces? Because brains don't detect ounces. They detect changes in ounces and differences in ounces. And the same is true for just about every physical property of an object. Our sensitivity to relative rather than absolute magnitudes isn't limited to physical properties such as weight, brightness, or volume. It extends to subjective properties such as value, goodness, and worth as well. For instance, most of us would be willing to drive across town to save $50 on the purchase of a $100 radio, but not on the purchase of a $100,000 automobile, because $50 seems like a fortune when we're buying radios, but a pittance when we're buying cars. Economists shake their heads at this kind of behavior and will correctly tell you that your bank account contains absolute dollars and not percentages off. If it's worth driving across town to save $50, then it doesn't matter which item you're saving it on, because when you spend these dollars on gas and groceries, the dollars won't know where they came from. But these economic arguments fall on deaf ears, because human beings don't think in absolute dollars. They think in relative dollars, and 50 is or isn't a lot of dollars depending on what it's relative to, which is why people who don't worry about whether their mutual fund manager is keeping 0.5 or 0.6% of their investment will nonetheless spend hours scouring the Sunday paper for a coupon that gives them 40% off a tube of toothpaste. Marketers, politicians, and other agents of influence know about our obsession with relative magnitudes and routinely turn it to their own advantage. For instance, one ancient ploy involves asking someone to pay an unrealistically large cost. Would you come to our Save the Bears meeting next Friday and then join us Saturday for a protest march at the zoo? Before asking them to pay a smaller cost. Okay then, could you at least contribute $5 to our organization? Studies show that people are much more likely to agree to pay the small cost after having first contemplated the large one, in part because doing so makes the small cost seem so, bearable. Because the subjective value of a commodity is relative, it shifts and changes depending on what we compare the commodity to. For instance, every morning on my walk to work, I stop at my neighborhood Starbucks and hand $1.89 to the barista, who then hands me 20 ounces of better-than-average coffee. I have no idea what it costs Starbucks to make this coffee, and I have no idea why they've chosen to charge me this particular amount. But I do know that if I stopped in one morning and found that the price had suddenly jumped to $2.89, I would immediately do one of two things. I would compare the new price to the price I used to pay, conclude that coffee at Starbucks had gotten too damned expensive, and invest in one of those vacuum-sealed travel mugs and start brewing my coffee at home. Or I would compare the new price to the price of other things I could buy with the same amount of cash. For example, 2 felt-tip markers, a 32-inch branch of artificial bamboo, or 1/100th of the 20-CD boxed set The Complete Miles Davis at Montreux. And I would conclude that the coffee at Starbucks was a bargain. In theory, I could make either of these comparisons, so which one would I actually make? We both know the answer to that. I'd make the easy one. When I encounter a $2.89 cup of coffee, it's all too easy for me to recall what I paid for coffee the day before, and not so easy for me to imagine all the other things I might buy with my money. Because it's so much easier for me to remember the past than to generate new possibilities, I'll tend to compare the present with the past even when I ought to be comparing it with the possible. And that is indeed what I ought to be doing, because it really doesn't matter what coffee cost the day before, the week before, or at any time during the Hoover administration. Right now, I have absolute dollars to spend, and the only question I need to answer is how to spend them in order to maximize my satisfaction. If an international bean embargo suddenly caused the price of coffee to skyrocket to $10,000 per cup, then the only question I would need to ask myself is, what else can I do with $10,000, and will it bring me more or less satisfaction than a cup of coffee? If the answer is more, then I should walk away. If the answer is less, then I should get a cup of coffee and an accountant with a whip. The fact that it's so much easier to remember the past than to generate the possible causes us to make plenty of weird decisions. For instance, people are more likely to purchase a vacation package that's been marked down from $600 to $500 than an identical package that costs $400 but that was on sale the previous day for $300. Because it's easier to compare a vacation package's price with its former price than with the price of other things one might buy, we end up preferring bad deals that have become decent deals to great deals that were once amazing deals. The same tendency leads us to treat commodities that have a memorable past differently than those that don't. For example, imagine that you have a $20 bill and a $20 concert ticket in your wallet, but when you arrive at the concert, you realize that you've lost the ticket en route. Would you buy a new one? Most people say no. Now imagine that instead of a $20 bill and a $20 concert ticket, you have two $20 bills in your wallet, and when you arrive at the concert, you realize that you've lost one of the bills en route. Would you buy a concert ticket? Most people say yes. It doesn't take a logician to see that the two examples are identical in all the ways that matter. In both cases, you've lost a piece of paper that was valued at $20, a ticket or a bill, and in both cases, you must now decide whether to spend the money that remains in your wallet on a concert. Nonetheless, our stubborn insistence on comparing the present to the past leads us to reason differently about these functionally equivalent cases. When we lose a $20 bill and then contemplate buying a concert ticket for the first time, the concert has no past. Hence, we correctly compare the cost of seeing the concert with other possibilities. Should I spend $20 to see the concert, or should I buy some new shark skin mittens? But when we lose a ticket we've previously purchased and contemplate replacing it, the concert has a past, and hence we compare the current cost of seeing the concert, $40, with its previous cost, $20, and feel disinclined to see a performance whose price has suddenly doubled. Comparing with the possible. We make mistakes when we compare with the past instead of the possible. When we do compare with the possible, we still make mistakes. For example, if you're like me, your living room is a mini warehouse of durable goods ranging from chairs and lamps to stereos and television sets. You probably shopped around a bit before buying these items, and you probably compared the one you ultimately bought with a few alternatives. Other lamps in the same catalog, other chairs on the showroom floor, other stereos on the same shelf, other televisions at the same mall. Rather than deciding whether to spend money, you were deciding how to spend money. And all the possible ways of spending your money were laid out for you by the nice folks who wanted it. These nice folks helped you overcome your natural tendency to compare with the past. Is this television really that much better than my old one? By making it extremely easy for you to compare with the possible. Well, when you see them side by side here in the store, the Panasonic has a much sharper picture than the Sony. Alas, we're all too easily fooled by such side-by-side comparisons, which is why retailers work so hard to ensure we make them. For example, people generally don't like to buy the most expensive item in a category, Hence, retailers can improve their sales by stocking a few very expensive items that no one actually buys, but that make less expensive items seem like a bargain by comparison. Unscrupulous real estate agents bring buyers to dilapidated dumps that are conveniently located between a massage parlor and a crack house before bringing them to the ordinary homes that they actually hope to sell, because the dumps make the ordinary homes seem extraordinary. Oh, look, honey, no needles on the lawn. Our side-by-side comparisons can be influenced by extreme possibilities, such as dilapidated houses, but they can also be influenced by the addition of extra possibilities that are identical to those we're already considering. For example, in one study, physicians read about medication X and were then asked whether they would prescribe the medication for a patient with osteoarthritis. The physicians clearly considered the medication worthwhile because only 28% of them chose not to prescribe it. But when another group of physicians was asked whether they would prescribe medication X or an equally effective medication Y for a patient with the same disease, 48% chose to prescribe nothing. Apparently, adding another equally effective medication to the list of possibilities made it difficult for the physicians to decide between the two medications, thus leading many of them to recommend neither. If you've ever caught yourself saying, "I'm having such a hard time deciding between these two movies that I think I'll just stay home and watch reruns instead," then you know why the physicians made the mistake they did. One of the most insidious things about side-by-side comparison is that it leads us to pay attention to any attribute that distinguishes the possibilities we're comparing. I've probably spent some of the unhappiest hours of my life in stores that I meant to visit for 15 minutes. I stop at the mall on the way to the picnic, park the car, dash in, and expect to reemerge a few minutes later with a nifty little digital camera in my pocket. But when I get to Wacky Bob's giant mega super really big world of cameras, I'm confronted by a bewildering panoply of nifty little digital cameras that differ on many attributes. Some of these are attributes that I would have considered even if there had only been one camera in the display case. This is light enough to fit in my shirt pocket so I can take it anywhere. And some are attributes I would never have thought about had the differences between cameras not been called to my attention. The Olympus has flash output compensation, but the Nikon doesn't. By the way, what is flash output compensation? Because side-by-side comparisons cause me to consider all the attributes on which the cameras differ, I end up considering attributes that I don't really care about, but that just so happen to distinguish one camera from another. For example, what attributes would you care about if you were shopping for a new dictionary? In one study, people were given the opportunity to bid on a dictionary that was in perfect condition and that listed 10,000 words, and on average, they bid $24. Other people were given the opportunity to bid on a dictionary with a torn cover that listed 20,000 words, and on average, they bid $20. But when a third group of people was allowed to compare the two dictionaries side by side, they bid $19 for the small, intact dictionary and $27 for the large, torn dictionary. Apparently, people care about the condition of a dictionary's cover, but they care about the number of words it contains only when that attribute is brought to their attention by side-by-side comparison. Comparing and presentism. Now, let's step back for a moment and ask what all of these facts about comparison mean for our ability to imagine future feelings. The facts are these. A. Value is determined by the comparison of one thing with another. B. There is more than one kind of comparison we can make in any given instance. And C. We may value something more highly when we make one kind of comparison than when we make a different kind of comparison. These facts suggest that if we want to predict how something will make us feel in the future, we must consider the kind of comparison we'll be making in the future and not the kind of comparison we happen to be making in the present. Alas, because we make comparisons without even thinking about them, man, that coffee's gotten expensive, or I'm not paying double to see this concert, we rarely consider the fact that the comparisons we're making now may not be the ones we'll be making later. For example, volunteers in one study were asked to sit at a table and predict how much they would enjoy eating potato chips a few minutes later. Some of the volunteers saw a bag of potato chips and a chocolate bar sitting on the table, and others saw a bag of potato chips and a tin of sardines sitting on the table. Did these extraneous foods influence the volunteers' predictions? You bet they did. Volunteers naturally compared the potato chips with the extraneous food, and they predicted that they'd like eating the potato chips more, when they compared the chips to the sardines than when they compared the chips to chocolate. But they were wrong, because when volunteers actually ate the potato chips, the sardine tin and the chocolate bar that were sitting on the table had no influence whatsoever on their enjoyment of the chips. After all, when one has a mouthful of crispy, salty, oily fried potatoes, another food item that just so happens to be sitting there on the table is largely irrelevant, just as the person you might have been making love with is largely irrelevant when you are in the middle of making love with someone else. What the volunteers didn't realize was that the comparisons they made as they imagined eating a chip, sure, chips are okay, but chocolate is so much better, were not the comparisons they would make when they were actually chowing down on one. Most of us have had similar experiences. We compare the small, elegant speakers with the huge, boxy speakers, notice the acoustical difference, and buy the hulking Leviathans. Alas, the acoustical difference is a difference we never notice again, because when we get the monster speakers home, we don't compare their sound to the sound of some speaker we listened to a week earlier at the store, but we do compare their awful boxiness to the rest of our sleek, elegant, and now spoiled decor. Or we travel to France, meet a couple from our hometown, and instantly become touring buddies because, compared with all those French people who hate us when we don't try to speak their language and hate us more when we do, the hometown couple seems exceptionally warm and interesting. We're delighted to have found these new friends, and we expect to like them just as much in the future as we do today. But when we have them over for dinner a month after returning home, we're surprised to find that our new friends are rather boring and remote compared with our regular friends, and that we actually dislike them enough to qualify for French citizenship. Our mistake wasn't in touring Paris with a couple of dull homies, but in failing to realize that the comparison we were making in France isn't the comparison we would be making when we got home. The same principle explains why we love new things when we buy them and then stop loving them shortly thereafter. When we start shopping for a new pair of sunglasses, we naturally contrast the hip, stylish ones in the store with the old, outdated ones that are sitting on our noses. So we buy the new ones and stick the old ones in a drawer, but after just a few days of wearing our new sunglasses, we stop comparing them with the old pair, and, well, what do you know? The delight that the comparison produced evaporates. The fact that we make different comparisons at different times, but don't realize that we will do so, helps explain some otherwise puzzling conundrums. For instance, economists and psychologists have shown that people expect losing a dollar to have more impact than gaining a dollar, which is why most of us would refuse a bet that gives us an 85% chance of doubling our life savings and a 15% chance of losing it. The likely prospect of a big gain just doesn't compensate for the unlikely prospect of a big loss, because we think losses are more powerful than equal-sized gains. But whether we think of something as a gain or a loss often depends on the comparisons we're making. For example, how much is a 1993 Mazda Miata worth? Well, according to my insurance company, the correct answer this year is about $2,000. But as the owner of a 1993 Mazda Miata, I can guarantee that if you wanted to buy my sweet little car with all of its adorable dents and mischievous rattles for a mere $2,000, you'd have to pry the keys out of my cold dead hands. I also guarantee that if you saw my car, you'd think that for $2,000 I should not only give you the car and the keys, but that I should throw in a bicycle, a lawnmower, and a lifetime subscription to The Atlantic. Why would we disagree about the fair value of my car? Because you would be thinking about the transaction as a potential gain. Compared with how I feel now, how happy will I be if I get this car? But I would be thinking about it as a potential loss. Compared with how I feel now, how happy will I be if I lose this car? I would want to be compensated for what I expected to be a powerful loss, but you wouldn't want to compensate me because you would be expecting a less powerful gain. What you would be failing to realize is that once you own my car, your frame of reference would shift, you would be making the same comparison that I'm now making, and that the car would be worth every penny you paid for it. What I would be failing to realize is that once I didn't own the car, my frame of reference would shift. I would be making the same comparison that you're making now, and that I'd be delighted with the deal because, after all, I'd never pay $2,000 for a car that was identical to the one I just sold you. The reason why we disagree on the price and quietly question each other's integrity and parenthood is that neither of us realizes that the kinds of comparisons we are naturally making as buyers and sellers are not the kinds of comparisons we will naturally make once we become owners and former owners. In short, the comparisons we make have a profound impact on our feelings, and when we fail to recognize that the comparisons we're making today are not the comparisons we'll make tomorrow, we predictably underestimate how differently we'll feel in the future. Onward. Historians use the word presentism to describe the tendency to judge historical figures by contemporary standards. As much as we all despise racism and sexism, these isms have only recently been considered moral turpitudes, and thus condemning Thomas Jefferson for keeping slaves or Sigmund Freud for patronizing women is a bit like arresting someone today for having driven without a seatbelt in 1923. And yet, the temptation to view the past through the lens of the present is nothing short of overwhelming. As the president of the American Historical Association noted, presentism admits of no ready solution. It turns out to be very difficult to exit from modernity. The good news is that most of us aren't historians, and thus we don't have to worry about finding that particular exit. The bad news is that all of us are futurians, and presentism is an even bigger problem when people look forward rather than backward. Because predictions about the future are made in the present, they're inevitably influenced by the present. The way we feel right now, I'm so hungry, and the way we think right now, the big speakers sound better than the little ones, exert an unusually strong influence on the way we think we'll feel later. Because time is such a slippery concept, we tend to imagine the future as the present with a twist. Thus, our imagined tomorrows inevitably look like slightly twisted versions of today. The reality of the moment is so palpable and powerful that it holds imagination in a tight orbit from which it never fully escapes. Presentism occurs because we fail to recognize that our future selves won't see the world the way we see it now. As we're about to learn, this fundamental inability to take the perspective of the person to whom the rest of our lives will happen is the most insidious problem a futurian can face. Part 5. Rationalization, the act of causing something to be or to seem reasonable. Chapter 8. Paradise Glossed. For there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Shakespeare, Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. Forget yoga, forget liposuction, and forget those herbal supplements that promise to improve your memory, enhance your mood, reduce your waistline, restore your hairline, prolong your lovemaking, and improve your memory. If you want to be happy and healthy, you should try a new technique that has the power to transform the grumpy, underpaid chump you are now into the deeply fulfilled, enlightened individual you've always hoped to be. If you don't believe me, then just consider the testimony of some folks who've tried it. J.W. from Texas says, I am so much better off physically, financially, mentally, and in almost every other way. M.B. from Louisiana says, it was a glorious experience. C.R. from California says, I didn't appreciate others nearly as much as I do now. Who are these satisfied customers, and what is the miraculous technique they're all talking about? Jim Wright, former Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, made his remark after committing 69 ethics violations and being forced to resign in disgrace. Maurice Bickham, a former inmate, made his remark upon being released from the Louisiana State Penitentiary, where he'd served 37 years for defending himself against the Ku Klux Klansman who'd shot him. And Christopher Reeve, the dashing star of Superman, made his remark after an equestrian accident left him paralyzed from the neck down, unable to breathe without the help of a ventilator. The moral of the story? If you want to be happy, healthy, wealthy, and wise, then skip the vitamin pills and the plastic surgeries and try public humiliation, unjust incarceration, or quadriplegia instead. Uh-huh, right. Are we really supposed to believe that people who lose their jobs, their freedom, and their mobility are somehow improved by the tragedies that befall them? If that strikes you as a far-fetched possibility, then you're not alone. For at least a century, psychologists have assumed that terrible events, such as having a loved one die or becoming the victim of a violent crime, must have a powerful, devastating, and enduring impact on those who experience them. This assumption has been so deeply embedded in our conventional wisdom that people who don't have dire reactions to events such as these are sometimes diagnosed as having a pathological condition known as absent grief. But recent research suggests that the conventional wisdom is wrong, that the absence of grief is quite normal, and that rather than being the fragile flowers that a century of psychologists have made us out to be, most people are surprisingly resilient in the face of trauma. The loss of a parent or spouse is usually sad and often tragic, and it would be perverse to suggest otherwise. But the fact is that while most bereaved people are quite sad for a while, very few become chronically depressed, and most experience relatively low levels of relatively short-lived distress. Although more than half the people in the United States will experience a trauma such as rape, physical assault, or natural disaster in their lifetimes, only a small fraction will ever develop any post-traumatic pathology or require any professional assistance. As one group of researchers noted, resilience is often the most commonly observed outcome trajectory following exposure to a potentially traumatic event. Indeed, studies of those who survive major traumas suggest that the vast majority do quite well, and that a significant portion claim that their lives were enhanced by the experience. I know, it sounds suspiciously like the title of a country song, but the fact is that most folks do pretty darn good when things go pretty darn bad. If resilience is all around us, then why are statistics such as these so surprising? Why do most of us find it difficult to believe that we could ever consider a lifetime behind bars to be a glorious experience, or come to see paralysis as a unique opportunity that gave a new direction to our lives? Why do most of us shake our heads in disbelief when an athlete who's been through several grueling years of chemotherapy tells us that I wouldn't change anything? Or when a musician who's become permanently disabled says, if I had to do it all over again, I would want it to happen the same way? Or when quadriplegics and paraplegics tell us that they're pretty much as happy as everyone else? The claims made by people who've experienced events such as these seem frankly outlandish to those of us who are merely imagining those events. And yet, who are we to argue with the folks who've actually been there? The fact is that negative events do affect us, but they generally don't affect us as much or for as long as we expect them to. When people are asked to predict how they'll feel if they lose a job or a romantic partner, if their candidate loses an important election or their team loses an important game, if they flub an interview, flunk an exam, or fail a contest, they consistently overestimate how awful they'll feel and how long they'll feel awful. Able-bodied people are willing to pay far more to avoid becoming disabled than disabled people are willing to pay to become able-bodied again, because able-bodied people underestimate how happy disabled people are. As one group of researchers noted, chronically ill and disabled patients generally rate the value of their lives in a given health state more highly than do hypothetical patients who are imagining themselves to be in such states. Indeed, healthy people imagine that 83 states of illness would be worse than death, and yet people who are actually in those states rarely take their own lives. If negative events don't hit us as hard as we expect them to, then why do we expect them to? If heartbreaks and calamities can be blessings in disguise, then why are their disguises so convincing? The answer is that the human mind tends to exploit ambiguity. And if that phrase seems ambiguous to you, then just keep listening and let me exploit it. Stop annoying people. The only thing more difficult than finding a needle in a haystack is finding a needle in a needle stack. When an object is surrounded by similar objects, it naturally blends in, and when it's surrounded by dissimilar objects, it naturally stands out. If I showed you a grid filled with numbers, such as 9 and 7 and 5, and another grid filled with letters, such as A and M and Z, you'd find that you could locate the letter O in the number grid a bit more quickly than you could locate it in the letter grid. And that makes sense, because it's harder to find a letter among letters than a letter among numbers. And yet, if I asked you to look for 0 instead of the letter O, you would be a bit faster to find it in the letter grid than in the number grid. Now, most of us think that a basic sensory ability, such as vision, is pretty well explained by its wiring, and if you wanted to understand this ability, you would do well to learn about luminance, contrast, rods, cones, optic nerves, retinas, and the like. But once you knew everything there was to know about the physical properties of the number grid and the letter grid, and everything there was to know about the anatomy of the human eye, you would still not be able to explain why a person can find the circle more quickly in one case than in the other, unless you also knew what that person thought the circle meant. Meanings matter for even the most basic psychological processes, And while this may seem perfectly obvious to reasonable folks like you and me, ignorance of this perfectly obvious fact sent psychologists on a wild goose chase that lasted nearly 30 years and produced relatively few geese. For much of the last half of the 20th century, experimental psychologists timed rats as they ran mazes and observed pigeons as they pecked keys because they believed that the best way to understand behavior was to map the relation between a stimulus and an organism's response to that stimulus. By carefully measuring what an organism did when it was presented with a physical stimulus, such as a light, a sound, or a piece of food, psychologists hoped to develop a science that linked observable stimuli to observable behavior without using vague and squishy concepts such as meaning to connect them. Alas, this simple-minded project was doomed from the start because while rats and pigeons may respond to stimuli as they are presented in the world, people respond to stimuli as they are represented in the mind. Objective stimuli in the world create subjective stimuli in the mind, and it's these subjective stimuli to which people react. Disambiguating objects. Most stimuli are ambiguous, that is, they can mean more than one thing. And the interesting question is how we disambiguate them, that is, how we know which of a stimulus's many meanings to infer on a particular occasion. Research shows that context, frequency, and recency are especially important in this regard. Consider context. The word bank has two meanings in English: a place where money is kept, and the land on either side of a river. Yet we never misunderstand sentences such as the boat ran into the bank or the robber ran into the bank because the words boat and robber provide a context that tells us which of the two meanings of bank we should infer in each case. Consider frequency. Our past encounters with the stimulus provide information about which of its meanings we should embrace. For example, a loan officer is likely to interpret the sentence, "Don't run into the bank," as a warning about how to ambulate through his place of business and not as sound advice about the steering of boats, because in the course of a typical day, the loan officer hears the word bank used more frequently in its financial than its maritime sense. Consider recency. Even a boater is likely to interpret the sentence, "Don't run into the bank," as a reference to a financial institution rather than a river's edge, if she recently saw an ad for safe deposit boxes and thus had the financial meaning of bank still active in her mind. Indeed, because I've been talking about banks in this paragraph, I'm willing to bet that the sentence, "he put a check in the box," causes you to generate a mental image of someone placing a piece of paper in a receptacle and not a mental image of someone making a mark on a questionnaire. I'm also willing to guess that your interpretation of the title of this section, "Stop Annoying People," depends on whether you annoyed someone more or less recently than someone annoyed you. Unlike rats and pigeons, then, we respond to meanings. And context, frequency, and recency are three of the factors that determine which meaning we'll infer when we encounter an ambiguous stimulus. But there's another factor of equal importance and greater interest. Like rats and pigeons, each of us has desires, wishes, and needs. We're not merely spectators of the world, but investors in it. And we often prefer that an ambiguous stimulus mean one thing rather than another. You've probably seen a very famous optical illusion called the Necker cube, after the Swiss crystallographer who discovered it in 1832. The Necker cube is a simple line drawing of a box that at first appears to be sitting on its side, and you have the sense that you're looking out at the box and that it's across from you. But if you stare long enough, the drawing suddenly shifts. The box appears to be standing on its end, and you have the sense that you're looking down on the box and that it's below you. If you're listening to this recording while driving, you should pull off at the next exit, locate a bookstore, and turn to page 158 so you can actually see the cube I'm talking about. If you're on a train or an airplane, this is probably not such a good idea. Because the Necker cube has two equally meaningful interpretations, your brain merrily switches back and forth between them, keeping you mildly entertained until you eventually get dizzy and fall down. But what if one of these meanings were better than the other? That is, what if you preferred one of the interpretations of this object? Experiments show that when subjects are rewarded for seeing the box across from them or below them, the orientation for which they were rewarded starts popping out more often, and their brains hold on to that interpretation without switching. In other words, when your brain is at liberty to interpret a stimulus in more than one way, it tends to interpret it the way it wants to, which is to say that your preferences influence your interpretation of stimuli in just the same way that context, frequency, and recency do. This phenomenon isn't limited to the interpretation of weird drawings. For example, why is it that you think of yourself as a talented person? Come on, give it up. You know you do. To answer this question, researchers asked some volunteers to write down their definition of talented, and then to estimate their talent using that definition as a guide. Next, some other volunteers were given the definitions that the first group had written down and were asked to estimate their own talent using those definitions as a guide. Interestingly, the volunteers in the first group who generated a definition of talent rated themselves as more talented than did the volunteers in the second group who were given a definition of talent. Because volunteers in the first group were given the liberty to define the word talented any way they wished, they defined it exactly the way they wished, namely, in terms of some activity at which they just so happened to excel. I think talent usually refers to exceptional artistic achievement, like, for example, this painting I've just finished. Or, talent means an ability you're born with, such as being much stronger than other people. Shall I put you down now? These volunteers were able to set the standards for talent, and not coincidentally, they were more likely to meet the standards they set. One of the reasons why most of us think of ourselves as talented, friendly, wise, and fair-minded is that these words are the lexical equivalents of a Necker cube, and the human mind naturally exploits each word's ambiguity for its own gratification. Disambiguating experience. Of course, the richest sources of exploitable ambiguity are not words, sentences, or shapes, but the intricate, variegated, multidimensional experiences of which every human life is a collage. If a Necker cube has two possible interpretations and talent has 14 possible interpretations, then leaving home or falling ill or getting a job with the U.S. Postal Service has hundreds or thousands of possible interpretations. The things that happen to us, getting married, raising a child, finding a job, resigning from Congress, going to prison, becoming paralyzed, are much more complex than an inky squiggle or a colored cube. And that complexity creates loads of ambiguity that just begs to be exploited. It doesn't have to beg hard. For example, volunteers in one study were told that they would be eating a delicious but unhealthy ice cream sundae, and others were told that they would be eating a bitter but helpful plate of fresh kale. Before actually eating these foods, the researchers asked the volunteers to rate the similarity of a number of foods, including ice cream sundaes, kale, and Spam, which everyone considered both unpalatable and unhealthful. The results showed that ice cream eaters thought that Spam was more like kale than it was like ice cream. Why? Because for some odd reason, ice cream eaters were thinking about food in terms of taste, and unlike kale and Spam, ice cream tastes delicious. On the other hand, kale eaters thought that Spam was more like ice cream than it was like kale. Why? Because for some odd reason, kale eaters were thinking about food in terms of its healthfulness. And unlike kale, ice cream and Spam are unhealthful. The odd reason isn't really so odd. Just as a Necker cube is both across from you and below you, ice cream is both fattening and tasty, and kale is both healthful and bitter. Your brain and my brain easily jump back and forth between these different ways of thinking about the foods because we're merely reading about them. But if we were preparing to eat one of them, our brains would automatically exploit the ambiguity of that food's identity and allow us to think of it in a way that pleased us, for example, as a delicious dessert or a nutritious veggie, rather than in a way that didn't, for example, as a fattening dessert or a bitter veggie. As soon as our potential experience becomes our actual experience, as soon as we have a stake in its goodness, our brains get busy looking for ways to think about the experience that will allow us to appreciate it. Because experiences are inherently ambiguous, finding a positive view of an experience is often as simple as finding the below-you view of a Necker cube. And research shows that most people do this well and often. Consumers evaluate kitchen appliances more positively after they buy them. Job seekers evaluate jobs more positively after they accept them. And high school students evaluate colleges more positively after they get into them. Racetrack gamblers evaluate their horses more positively when they're leaving the betting window than when they're approaching it. And voters evaluate their candidates more positively when they're exiting the voting booth than when they're entering it. A toaster, a firm, a university, a horse, and a senator are all just fine and dandy, but when they become our toaster, firm, university, horse, and senator, they're instantly finer and dandier. Studies such as these suggest that people are quite adept at finding a positive way to view things once those things become their own. Cooking with Facts. In Voltaire's classic novel, Candide, Dr. Pangloss is a teacher of metaphysico-theologo-cosmolo-negology, who believes he lives in the best of all possible worlds. It is clear, he said, that things cannot be other than the way they are, for as all things have been created for some end, they must necessarily be created for the best end. For instance, noses were made to support spectacles, hence we wear spectacles. Legs, as anyone can see, were made for breeches, and so we wear breeches. Stones were made to be shaped into castles, thus my lord has a fine castle because the greatest baron in the province ought to have the finest house. And because pigs were made to be eaten, we eat pork all year round. So those who say that everything is well are speaking foolishly. They should say that everything is best. The research I've described so far seems to suggest that human beings are hopelessly Panglossian. There are more ways to think about experience than there are experiences to think about, and human beings are unusually inventive when it comes to finding the best of all possible ways. And yet, if this is true, then why aren't we all walking around with wide eyes and loopy grins, thanking God for the wonder of hemorrhoids and the miracle of in-laws? Because the mind may be gullible, but it ain't no patsy. The world is this way. We wish the world were that way. And our experience of the world, how we see it, remember it, and imagine it, is a mixture of stark reality and comforting illusion. We can't spare either. If we were to experience the world exactly as it is, we'd be too depressed to get out of bed in the morning. But if we were to experience the world exactly as we want it to be, we'd be too deluded to find our slippers. We may see the world through rose-colored glasses, but rose-colored glasses are neither opaque nor clear. They can't be opaque because we need to see the world clearly enough to participate in it, to pilot helicopters, harvest corn, diaper babies, and all the other stuff that smart mammals need to do in order to survive and thrive. But they can't be clear because we need their rosy tint to motivate us to design the helicopters. I'm sure this thing will fly. Plant the corn. This year will be a banner crop. And tolerate the babies. What a bundle of joy. We cannot do without reality, and we cannot do without illusion. Each serves a purpose, each imposes a limit on the influence of the other, and our experience of the world is the artful compromise that these tough competitors negotiate. Rather than thinking of people as hopelessly Panglossian, then, we might think of them as having a psychological immune system that defends the mind against unhappiness in much the same way that the physical immune system defends the body against illness. This metaphor is unusually appropriate. For example, the physical immune system must strike a balance between two competing needs, the need to recognize and destroy foreign invaders such as viruses and bacteria, and the need to recognize and respect the body's own cells. If the physical immune system is hypoactive, it fails to defend the body against micro-predators and we are stricken with infections. But if the physical immune system is hyperactive, it mistakenly defends the body against itself, and we're stricken with autoimmune disease. A healthy physical immune system must balance its competing needs and find a way to defend us well, but not too well. Analogously, when we face the pain of rejection, loss, misfortune, and failure, the psychological immune system must not defend us too well, I'm perfect and everyone is against me, and must not fail to defend us well enough, I'm a loser and I ought to be dead. A healthy psychological immune system strikes a balance that allows us to feel good enough to cope with our situation, but bad enough to do something about it. Yeah, that was a lousy performance, and I feel crummy about it, but I've got enough confidence to give it a second shot. We need to be defended, not defenseless or defensive. And thus, our minds naturally look for the best view of things while simultaneously insisting that those views stick reasonably closely to the facts. That's why people seek opportunities to think about themselves in positive ways, but routinely reject opportunities to think about themselves in unrealistically positive ways. For example, college students request new dorm assignments when their current roommates don't think well of them, but they also request new dorm assignments when their current roommates think too well of them. No one likes to feel that they're being duped, even when the duping is a pleasure. In order to maintain the delicate balance between reality and illusion, we seek positive views of our experience, but we only allow ourselves to embrace those views when they seem credible. So what makes a view seem